coming up.
Induction, deduction,
reduction, abduction.
Is the simplest explanation always the best?
The day I met you, there was a white substance on your shoe that I mistook for plaster. Yesterday, I saw the same white substance outside the hut where the bat was kept, and suddenly it hit me. The great white bat has great white guano. That's what you slipped in. That's what was on your shoe. And that explains the abrasion on your palm.
When there are many different ways to explain the same event, how do we decide which is best?
Isn't the most elegant explanation always the best?
You have a hand inside of you.
That explains so many things.
Why think elegance is a guide to truth?
That will explain these costumes.
Quite right, number one.
Isn't the best explanation always the one that explains more with less?
What you're writing, Slats? My thoughts. That would explain all the blank pages.
Explanation at its best.
Lovely explanation you've got there. Be a shame if it turned out to be bogus.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Thursday, May 19th, come be part of Philosophy Talk's first live recording in over 2 years on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the changing face of anti-Semitism with historian Francesca Trivolato.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. in Leventhal Hall at the Stanford Humanities Center.
We can't wait to see you there.
What makes an explanation a good explanation?
Isn't the simplest explanation always the best?
Why do people often swallow such crazy explanations?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about explanation at its best.
Oh, so Josh, suppose you have like two competing explanations of the same thing. How do you think we should go about deciding between them?
I'll start with the simpler one. I mean, that one's going to be more likely to be true, right?
Well, maybe, but sometimes a simple explanation can be too simple, can't it?
Yeah, okay, look, we shouldn't make explanations so simple that it can't account for the facts. But, you know, let's not make it more complicated than we have to.
Yeah, but then that raises the question of how we strike a balance between too simple on one hand and too complex on the other.
Yeah, there aren't any hard and fast rules. It's more a case-by-case kind of thing.
So you mean you kind of know it when you see it, kind of like pornography or something?
Something like that. I mean, not exactly like that. It's true that there isn't an algorithm for it, but there is a name for it. It's called abductive inference.
Ah, now that's a mouthful. I bet you most people are familiar with the notion of induction and probably deduction, but abduction?
Well, it's also called inference to the best explanation, if that helps.
Oh, actually, I don't think that helps at all. How about you give an example instead?
Sure, okay. Suppose you're a detective investigating the murder of Jimmy Socrates, okay? you've got two main suspects, Freddie Nietzsche and Tommy Hobbes.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
Excellent. Here's the case against Nietzsche. He and Socrates were spotted having a heated argument shortly before Socrates' death, and the police found the murder weapon in the bushes in Nietzsche's backyard.
Wow, that case sounds pretty damning. So, okay, what's Tommy Hobbes' story?
Okay, Tommy Hobbes hated Socrates too, and that night an eyewitness saw a man matching Hobbes' description running from the scene of the crime.
So maybe Hobbes is our man. Eyewitness testimony, you know?
Not so fast, Ken. Only an hour after the murder, Hobbes was spotted in a restaurant 100 miles away having a quiet, intimate dinner with his partner.
Oh, Josh, okay. Well, this is an interesting case. It seems to me we got ourselves in something of a pickle. We've got inconclusive evidence that supports two different hypotheses. It seems to me the only way we're going to possibly decide between them, we got to dig for more evidence. We got to go do some detecting.
I don't agree. I think we've got enough evidence already. I mean, surely it's clear that Nietzsche did it.
What? How?
Well, if he didn't do it, how did the gun get into his yard? And how did Hobbes get so far away so fast? See, Ken, abduction's cool. It helps us find the best explanation without a lot of messing about.
Oh, gosh, yes. Look, I'm willing to concede that that may be the simplest explanation, but I don't know why you think that's the best explanation.
Well, you got a better idea?
Well, yeah, try this one out. I mean, okay, Tommy Hobbes, he's a really devious guy. He's like framing Nietzsche. Knowing that they would come to blows, he arranged for Nietzsche and Socrates to meet where he knew they would be seen. And then after they part company, Hobbes murders Socrates and then plants the gun in his backyard. What do you think about that?
I think you're missing out a really important detail.
Now, which, what would that be?
That's the fact that there's an intimate dinner 100 miles away,
I know, I know. Look. Hobbes's his helicopter was parked in a nearby heliport. He kills Socrates, gets into the chopper, drops the gun as he flies over the yard, lands the chopper 100 miles away where a driver is waiting to take him to his dinner date. Touché, a better explanation.
What are you smoking, Ken?
I'm not smoking anything, and how can you resist? Have you even bothered to check out heliports in the area for suspicious takeoffs and landings, Josh?
No, and I don't intend to either.
Well, then how can you be so confident that you know what the best explanation is? I mean, you're not even willing to consider every logically possible explanation. That's like choosing your presidential candidate without hearing the other 22 who are in the debate.
You know, that, Ken, that's the beauty of abductive inference. You don't have to drive yourself crazy searching for evidence to rule out every conceivable alternative. You know, if an alternative is ad hoc or too complicated, helicopters, or it's inconsistent with what we already know, we can just ignore it.
But how do you know, Josh? Here's the crucial thing. How do you know which alternatives are worth taking seriously and which aren't, Mr. Sherlock?
Well, that's a long story.
Well, you know why? Because your abductive inference, your inference to the best explanation, it's just hocus pocus.
No,
it's just magic.
No. It's something that people do all the time and that they're remarkably good at. And not just scientists, regular folk like you and me. Even babies do it, Ken.
Okay, Josh, look, I'm not completely convinced. I'm willing to listen and learn. And to help us get a better sense of how inference to the best explanation is supposed to work, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to investigate how one of the world's most famous detectives uses it to get to the bottom of things. She files this report.
A dense yellow fog swirls through the streets of London. It is here we find our hero, Sherlock Holmes, sitting in a cocaine-induced haze at 221B Baker Street.
I can strongly recommend a 7% solution of cocaine. Would you care to try it?
Holmes is engulfed by melancholy. He yearns for mysteries to solve.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle created Sherlock Holmes back in 1887. Conan Doyle was a scientist and a trained physician, and his fictional detective used scientific methods and forensic evidence before the actual police did. Holmes says simple explanations are sometimes the correct ones.
Every problem is absurdly simple when it is explained to you. Bump, 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 bump.
But just as often, the unlikely explanations can be correct.
How often have I said to you, once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Holmes relies on deductive, inductive, and abductive reasoning to solve crimes. Deductive reasoning begins with a broad truth, then a minor premise, and finally a conclusion.
Certainly there are instances where basically a case is solved by pretty straightforward sort of, if this, then that must be true.
Phil Tallon is the co-editor of The Philosophy of Sherlock Holmes. He says one example of this is in the Holmes story, The Adventures of the Three Students. In this story, a cheater is afoot and has copied answers to an exam.
The cheater must have been tall enough to look in through the window to see that the exam papers were there. Only one of the three students is tall enough, and so therefore, this tall student must be the one who did the cheating.
With inductive reasoning, Holmes makes an observation, then reaches a conclusion. For example, he can identify 140 different types of cigar based on ash.
So he studies pipe ashes and observes that, okay, when something looks like this, then it must have come from here. He kind of moves, as it were, from the particular back to the general.
So he can examine cigarette ash at a crime scene and use his insight into ash to make a guess about how suspects died or who killed who. But there's more to Holmes' method than brains. Tim Wilden is a professor of philosophy and theology at the University of St. Francis.
What won it for him was really this appeal to the heart, or these summary evaluative judgments that stem from intuition.
Holmes uses abductive reasoning in The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle. That kind of reasoning involves an incomplete observation, then a prediction. So it means more intuition is at play. For example, one day around Christmas, Holmes examines a dusty hat. He guesses it must belong to an intellectual fellow because of the cubic capacity of the hat. Then he guesses the wearer of the hat has lost his wife's affection.
So, what do we have? A gray-haired intellectual who 3 years ago was well-to-do but has since fallen on hard times. He once had foresight, he now has less. His wife has ceased to love him, and it is doubtful if he has gas laid on in his house.
When Holmes does identify the thief, he relies on his intuition again. He concludes turning him over to the police would only turn him into a hardened criminal.
Holmes thought it was the time of year and the disposition of the thief that warranted some kind of letting go or exoneration. You usually don't see that in any kind of detective fiction.
That moment may seem compassionate, but Holmes is operating purely out of rational judgment. As he would say to his only friend Watson, "I am brain, the rest is mere appendix." You won't find emotion from Sherlock Holmes, but he still has a lot to teach us.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
That wasn't elementary. That was awesome, Holly, and the game is afoot. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about explanation at its best.
We're joined now by Tanya Lombroso, professor of psychology at Princeton University and director of the Concepts and Cognition Lab. Tanya, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Tanya, you're a psychologist. I know you have a deep background in philosophy from your Stanford days and beyond. But I wonder what first drew you to this topic. Is it the philosopher in you or the psychologist in you or what?
I think it's a bit of both. I think the psychologist in me was always really interested in explaining why people do the things they do. And then the philosopher in me turned that explanatory impulse on itself and asked, I wonder why I'm so curious about this, right? And one of the things that I found really puzzling, even starting in high school and especially as an undergraduate, was why we bother to explain it all. So often when we try to make sense of things, it's obvious why it'd be valuable to be able to predict them or to be able to control them, bring something about that's good or prevent something that's bad. But when we're explaining, typically we're explaining something that already happened, right? You run into a friend who's angry and you wonder, why is this person angry? And it would have been great to prevent it. It'd be great to be able to predict it next time so you're prepared. But why do we bother explaining things that already happened? And I think there's good answers to that puzzle, but that's really what got me thinking about it as a really important psychological and philosophical kind of problem.
Yeah, that's a great puzzle. I'm sure we'll get to that. But before we get to that, let me ask even a more elementary puzzle, not to paraphrase Holmes. What is explanation? I mean, it's such a fascinating topic, but it's also so complex. Tell us, if you can, in a few words, what explanation is in the first place.
I would say that an explanation is an answer to a why question that generates understanding.
That sounds like Aristotle.
That is a pithy definition.
Yeah, that's very pithy. I mean, he thought there were different kinds of why questions, right? Do you agree with that? I mean, the Aristotelian thought is, yeah, explanations answers why questions. And Judea Pearl has this new autobiography, intellectual biography, the question of why, or I think it's called. But aren't there different kinds of why questions? So are there different kinds of explanations?
I think that's true. I think there's lots of different kinds of explanations. I think one kind of explanation that's very common is when we try to give a causal story that explains why something came about. So for example, you're trying to make a cake and you open the oven and it didn't rise at all. And you say, why didn't my cake rise? In a case like that, it seems what you're looking for is some sort of a causal story about what went wrong in the causal process that was supposed to lead to a rising. But that's just one kind of explanation. Aristotle had at least three others, and I think there's other distinctions we could draw as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I ask why did that friend get so angry at me, I'm not looking for, I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for a mechanism, like what turns the gears of his or her anger. I'm talking about a reason. What reason, if any, did the person, right? And that's a different kind of explanation than a mechanism. Or do you think that they're different kinds?
I think that they are psychologically different. I think there's a further question of what the relationship is between them. But I do think that when we ask a why question looking for a reason, we're reasoning about that differently than when we ask a why question looking for a causal mechanism. And I think both of those are somewhat different from what we're looking for when we ask for an explanation in terms of a function or a goal. So, for example, right. if you walk into a kitchen store that has all sorts of new kitchen gadgets and you see something that's sort of like the strange shape, you say, well, you know, why does it have this strange part poking out over here? You want to know what's that for, right? Why was it designed that way? What's the function or goal of that property? And that's yet another kind of explanation.
It seems like mechanistic explanations would be more appropriate for objects in the natural world. So, you know, why do trees exist? Well, give some kind of, you know, Darwinian story or something like that. Whereas why do strainers exist? Presumably for that, you know, they're generated by human beings who have intentions. So presumably there you'd want more like a functional story. Is that about right?
I think that's right, but it gets more complicated when you think about things like the products of natural selection.
I agree.
For example, if you want to know why zebras have stripes, you probably want to know what the function of that is if it has a function.
Right, exactly. And you want to know what the function is, even though there's not like an intelligent designer. So I agree with you. It's a complicated thing. Sorting through all the kinds of explanations, we're not going to do that because that would be a whole show unto itself. But we'll talk about this a little bit more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about explanation with Tanya Lombroso from Princeton University.
What makes an explanation a good explanation? When you've got two good ones, how do you decide which is better? Is simplicity always a virtue? Or are there times when it's best to sacrifice simplicity in order to achieve greater accuracy?
Explanations, the good, the better, and the best, when Philosophy Talk continues. If an explanation seems overly complicated, could that be because some things are just hard to explain? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about explanation at its best. Our guest is Princeton psychologist Tanya Lombroso.
So Tanya, clearly, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of explanations, we granted that, but there's another sense in which not all explanations are created equal. I mean, there are good explanations, there are bad explanations, and there are beautiful explanations. I think I heard that trio from a wise person once. Two related questions for you. What makes an explanation a good explanation? And then second question, what makes one explanation better than another? Let's start with the first. What makes an explanation a good explanation? Then we'll transition to the second.
Sure. So I think typically when we're trying to explain, we're explaining why one thing held rather than another. So for example, you come home one day and you expected your partner to have picked up Chinese takeout on the way home. But when you get home, you discover that the food that your partner picked up is Thai food. And so you say, why did you get Chinese? And implicitly, you're asking, why did you get Chinese as opposed to Thai food?
Right.
And a good explanation is going to be one that allows you to understand why it was Chinese rather than Thai food.
And that doesn't make you divorce your partner.
Absolutely. And the contrast there matters, right? Because you might have, if you arrived home at 2 o'clock and weren't expecting food at all, you might ask, why is there Chinese food rather than there being no food at all?
So look, part of the way you said that, it makes it sound like you believe, and I just want to make this explicit, explanation is always a contrastive. There are competing like hypotheses or something like that, and an explanation, and you like you have to choose between them or something. Do you think that's right? That explanation,
I think,
is always
explanation is, it's almost always contrastive. And I think the contrast is often not explicit, so it can be subtle. But you often ask for an explanation when something violated your expectations or was surprising, that doesn't fit in with your view of the world in some way you think you might learn from trying to explain. And so you're asking, well, why was it like this rather than this other way, which is what I expected or would have understood already.
But I want to go back to Josh's rejection of my contrasting explanation as a non-starter. I'm going to write a novel in which a mystery novel in which my story is true and everybody's misled. So because nobody thinks it's a reasonable contrast.
Like Tommy Hobbes is framing Freddie Nietzsche.
Yeah. Where does the contrast class come from? Does the world just say, "Oh, contrast this thing with that thing," or is the contrast class generated by us? Or I mean, where does the contrast class come from in the first place?
I think it comes from human psychology, right? So we've built up this repertoire of expectations about the way the world works. And part of what prompts us to seek an explanation in the first place is that we encounter some sort of an observation that maybe we realize is not already accounted for by what we know about the world. And so that prompts us to ask a question.
Yeah, but then I wonder if it comes just from human psychology and if it's not like the world's options, why are we so confident that by showing that this member of the contrast class beats all the other members of the contrast class that we're going to get at the truth about the thing. You know what I mean? Because maybe there's something not in, because of our psychology, not in the contrast class that ought to be there.
Maybe Socrates isn't dead at all. Right? Maybe there's options we're not even thinking about.
Yeah.
That's right. Maybe there's a third suspect out there who we should catch. I think we shouldn't be so confident a lot of the time. I think, in fact, we should often be suspicious of our explanatory preferences, precisely because there's no guarantee that there's going to be a good match between what we think is a good or satisfying explanation and the way the world actually works. I think there's some circumstances under which it can be a pretty good strategy to favor the explanations we like best. But there's definitely no guarantee, so I think we should be wary.
Okay, so we don't have a guarantee, but are there at least some rules of thumb? For example, you know, people often mention Occam's razor, simplicity. If you've got a couple of at least reasonably plausible candidate explanations for some surprising phenomenon, do you think it makes sense to opt for the simpler one?
So I think I like to distinguish between what I call explanatory virtues, which are things that seem like good properties of explanations, and explanatory vices, which strike us as good properties of explanations, but where we really probably should try to ignore them. And I think simplicity probably is an explanatory virtue, as are many other things that psychologists and philosophers have proposed. So, for example, we tend to prefer explanations that are not only simple, but that are broad in scope, in the sense that they explain all the observations we want them to explain, that are unifying. They take lots of different kinds of phenomena and give them a common explanation. We like explanations that are consistent with our prior beliefs. We often like explanations that tell us what the causal mechanism is that was involved, or that are fruitful in the sense that they prompt further inquiry. So I think all of those are good candidates for explanatory virtues and should be distinguished from the vices, which I can tell you about in a moment.
Okay, that is a great list, right? So fruitful, broad, simple. These are excellent. But can I press you a little bit on the simplicity? I mean, think about Fermat's last theorem, for example, right? That famous theorem that he said he didn't have enough space in the margin for the proof of his theorem. I mean, no kidding. I mean, it took Andrew Waza like 129 pages. So, I mean, my point is, aren't there cases where explanations, where the phenomena of the world are actually so complicated that we need a complicated explanation? And if we're opting for a simple one over a complicated one, maybe we're just making a mistake. Maybe it could be an explanatory vice, not a virtue.
I think some of the time we are making a mistake, but there might be good reasons why it's a good strategy to start with a simple explanation. So one reason why it might be a good strategy is because the simple explanation is typically going to rule out more possibilities. It's sort of going to be consistent with a smaller set of options in the world, and so it's going to be easier to test if it's true. So if you make the mistake of picking the simple thing, you'll quickly discover that you're wrong. If you make the mistake of choosing a really complicated thing, that might be a really hard idea to test or to verify based on any observation. So you're going to hang out with this false complicated theory longer than you really ought to. So that's one reason why it might be a good strategy, even if it's not true that the world is actually simple.
So I agree with you, but I want to test out an intuition, a hunch that I'm having about why you think some of the things you think. Because I think it's really important that you approach this as partly a philosophically trained person, but I also think the psychologist in you is playing a major role. I'm not saying that as a criticism. I'm just trying to explore something, because I am wondering, is all these explanatory virtues that you say that we think of explanation as having, I agree with a lot of those explanatory virtues, but I wonder what makes them virtue? Is that a fact about the world just is built this way, so that the simplest story is true, the most general, you know, it's full of general facts and laws rather than particular matters of fact? Or is it just that our minds, like, are designed to try and make the world be this way? Or is it that there's a pre-established harmony, or maybe an evolutionarily established harmony between our minds and the way the world works? I mean, why do we think of the virtues of explanation as virtues? Because it seems to me that's like not the result of hard-won experience necessarily, but maybe something about the architecture of our minds. I wonder what you think.
Yeah, I think I agree that the world comes into this, right? So I think it's going to have to do with the relationship between the world, the structure of the world, and the structure of our explanatory preferences. And of the views you laid out, I think the evolutionary harmony view is kind of an attractive one, right? The idea is that we had to evolve to be the sorts of creatures who can actually identify real structure in the world so that we can learn to predict what's going to happen next. We can learn how things work so we can fix them, and we can build bridges and do all of these sorts of things.
Right, if we were getting everything wrong all the time, presumably we wouldn't have survived so long.
Yeah, but if evolution's such a great designer, why aren't we getting everything right all the time? Why did we take a march through phlogiston theory and water as a simple element and vitalism? Why? I mean, history is littered with our explanatory failures, right?
I think the world's a pretty complicated place. I'd be asking quite a lot of evolution to have quantum mechanics built in there along with all of our other contemporary scientific ideas. The way I think about it is that we have a kind of ideal explanation that we're looking for in the world. And the world is rarely going to reward us by giving us an ideal explanation. It's always going to be more complicated and less beautiful than we'd like. But maybe it's a really good strategy to approach the world looking for that ideal explanation, because it's going to make us look in creative ways. It's going to make us go beyond the obvious to try to find that simple underlying structure. Yeah. And that might turn out to be really valuable for learning.
Yeah, so you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about explanation at its best with Tanya Lombroso, who's one of the best at explaining explanation. And we'd love to have your contributions. And Ariel from San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ariel. What's your comment or question?
Yes, just a couple comments that... One is ignoring maybe the motivation of the speaker and who the audience is and what is the conscience behind the speech, and that we can see today with our climate crisis, which is urgent, sometimes we try to explain to people about the need to take action, and you can explain maybe deftly, and there's no sense of responsibility, or there's some kind of disconnect between the response and the explanation. And another example of that is like when, the President Trump is accused of bribery, and they generally use cognitive dissonance or accusing their opponents of exactly what their audience is thinking about them. So he accuses his critics of being corrupt. And this kind of explanation in which psychology is used to skew the interpretation is so important to be able to analyze today to navigate through the media.
Ariel, there's a lot there, and I wanted to give Tanya a chance to dig into some of it. Thanks for the call. I think the general point about that Ariel is making is one that's about the use and abuse of explanations. I mean, if our minds are just designed to try and find good explanations, there's a lot of crappy explanations out there, and people parade explanations that are crappy explanations as good explanations with all kinds of motives, and we sometimes fall for that. What's up with that?
Yeah, I think Ariel raises some really great points, and this is a good point to bring in the idea of explanatory vices. There are things that make us like explanations when we probably shouldn't, and some of the most prevalent ones are ones that come up in the examples that she raised. So, for example, there's a general psychological phenomenon called motivated reasoning. We often try to make things fit what we want to believe. And one thing that might make us want to believe something could be our political orientation, but another thing could be that it's a really beautiful explanation. So I think we have to watch out for motivated reasoning as one thing that might lead us astray when it comes to thinking about explanations.
Give me more of a list of explanatory vices, because I take your point, but now we're talking about the downside of our kind of explanation mongering, and I want to know more about that. So tell me more about explanatory vices.
Yeah, so one thing that psychological research has suggested is that people are often swayed by superficial characteristics of explanations, like the use of jargon. So non-experts who hear some neuroscience sprinkled into a psychology explanation, or who have some math sprinkled into a science explanation, will think that makes it better.
Yeah, I've heard that 87% of people do that.
I heard that 87... No. I heard that 87.689% of people do that.
I'm convinced. So that's something we need to be concerned about. Another one is there's evidence that people like explanations that appeal to inherent properties of what they're trying to explain. So, for example, if you wanted to explain why girls dress in pink very often, at least right now in the U.S., the real explanation probably has to do with all sorts of historically contingent facts, right? In other times and places, pink has not been associated with girls or been a feminine color, but right now it is. But this human psychological bias is going to lead people to try to find some match between the inherent properties of being a girl and the inherent properties of pink and give an explanation that links those inherent properties. But, you know, the world often doesn't have those kinds of explanations, and so that's often something that's going to lead us astray.
Well, is that because, I mean, I see that that's a vice, and I see that it's a highly impactful vice. It's not just girls, it's racial groups and all this sort of all this stuff. That's where the essentializing tendencies that we have and try to combat come from. But so I wonder something. I mean, I see that this is a vice, but it's also, it's kind of part of the coin, because if we're looking for like the world's own categories, if our mind is thinking that these are the world's categories, and the world's categories will be predictive and deep and explanatory. And if we think like race or gender is the world's category, not just our category, then it kind of comes with the turf that we're going to think of it that way, right?
I think sometimes it'll be fruitful to think that way. But I think even basic cases about the natural world are often a little more complicated than this idea of an inherent property. So even something like the density of a material is going to be a relational property because it has to do with both its mass and its volume.
Right.
So even that like very basic aspect of the physical world that we do think, I think, carves nature at its joints in an important way, isn't going to be inherent in this sense. So probably I'd say in most cases, I think, looking for inherent is not going to be at least true as a description of the world. Again, it might be a good strategy that gets us, latches right. us onto properties of the world, but then gets us onto a more complicated picture.
But I want to ask you a deeply philosophical question. You can ignore it if you want. I don't know if it's like, I wonder if there's a question. You mentioned carving nature as its joints. So let's think there are certain joint carving properties. We think nature has its joints. Okay. And so part of our minds is looking out for what are nature's joint carving properties, and we're trying to figure those out. And then there are other properties that don't carve nature at the joints. I mean, they're human inventions or social constructions. Psychologically speaking, is there a difference in our brains and the way these kind of predicates and kinds sit in our minds? I say, this is a kind that's supposed to carve nature at its joints. This is a kind that's just thrown on us by the social world, and I got to treat them differently. Does our psychology at all reflect that?
There is evidence that at the extremes, you get quite big differences. So, for example, the way people think about gold is as something that really carves nature at its joints. And if I suddenly made up a new category, like white things that I first observed on a Tuesday, you probably don't think that's a real category. And so if we take those extreme cases, you find distinct psychological signatures of how we reason about those categories. But then you get a lot of sort of gray stuff in the middle. So, for example, mental disorders are a category where people vary in how they think about it, and it has some of the properties of the way people think about natural kinds and some of the properties of the way people think about more conventional kinds of categories. So even though the endpoints might be clear, there's a lot in the middle.
Yeah, this is complicated stuff, Tanya. This is really deep stuff. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about explanation at its best with Tanya Lombroso, director of the Concepts in Cognition Lab at Princeton University.
Human beings are relentless explainers, but not every explanation we produce is a good one. Indeed, people sometimes believe remarkably bad explanations. So how do we become better producers and consumers of explanations?
Making better explanations and making better explainers when Philosophy Talk continues. If he just wants you to tell him why it happened, maybe you need to become a better explainer. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Princeton psychologist Tanya Lombroso, and we're asking about how we explain things.
And we've got a caller, Phil from Oakland, on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phil. What's your comment or question?
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. The question is about sort of how we ask more radical questions and how, you know, asking a question can presuppose the context for its answer. So, like, if we are metaphysical realists and we're wondering, oh, well, how do we explain the world? And we're trying to find a better explanation, but we're looking for an explanation that's going to be, like, having a kind of reference and having a kind of materialism involved in it. And so I guess I'm kind of curious about how, you know, on our pursuit to get better explanations, sometimes we can do the entire thing for even hundreds of years, all within the mindset that the paradigm is going to have an answer with a flavor that we expect it to have. And
yeah.
So I'm kind of curious about that.
So, Tanya, you got an answer for Phil? That's a complicated question. I'll let you make of it what you will.
It is. I think that's a great question. Yeah. So I think there's one aspect of explanation that means that we tend to be sort of conservative when we're explaining. We try to explain things in a way that fits in with our prior beliefs. We want to make sense of it. And so we're going to be often less inclined to posit these radical things that we don't yet really understand. But that's often what's needed to pose radical questions like Phil suggested, or to have a scientific revolution of some kind. In terms of strategies for asking more radical questions, I think one thing is that I mentioned earlier in the show that often when we ask an explanation, we have sort of an implicit contrast in mind. I think being clear about what that contrast is can be a first step towards having a better sense of what we're presupposing and even asking the question. And then maybe trying to think more broadly about other ways things could have been.
Yeah. So I wonder what you think. I mean, this is really, I think this is a deeply important question. Because you said, I mean, I don't know if what you said or Josh said or something. I mean, there's how scientists do it. And there's how we as individuals do it, the individual learner, the child as scientist. But here's the thing about science is that it's an elaborate social structure in which the individual fits in as part. And it's got this elaborate system of rewards, and upsetting a scientific apple cart with the theory of quantum gravity or something, or quantum mechanics, or the theory of evolution, eventually that gets you great rewards, right? In the individual case, when we don't have this elaborate social structure, it's a little different. So I wonder how much of this kind of revolutionary capacity for evolution is rooted in just individual psychology, and how much of it depends on there being a social structure that rewards and encourages that. I don't know if you've thought about that, because that's not a purely psychological kind of question.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's an important disanalogy between our sort of everyday quasi-scientific reasoning and the way that the institutional structure of science works. I think there probably are important differences, but I also would want to emphasize all of the resources we have as individuals for thinking in more creative sorts of ways. So one speculation that I'm curious if Josh would agree with is that if you look at other things that we do, like read science fiction and engage in thought experiments and all sorts of imaginative exercises and so on, one way to think about some of what's going on there is that we're exploring the space of possible explanations in a way that we're doing in a way that's unconstrained by what we might think is true of the real world right now, but that might open our eyes to other kinds of possibilities that we might then actually come to adopt in the future.
Well, it may surprise you to hear this, but I agree with you very strongly. that's a beautiful way of thinking about one of the virtues of science fiction. And, you know, I wonder whether, because obviously we've got a whole host of explanatory vices that you've talked about, right? And I think about people's readiness to accept certain kinds of wacky conspiracy theories, and the confirmation bias you were talking about earlier, and the way in which our emotions get involved, and we bring to the table these prior senses of how the world works, and people seem to tend to want to have one size fits all explanations, right? Everything is neoliberalism. Everything is sex or whatever the explanations. So I guess I'm wondering, science fiction or something else, what's gonna be the best remedy for these explanatory vices? How do we get people to recognize that sometimes they're being led astray and picking the bad explanation and tempt them to a better path?
So Josh is doing something to you. I mean, you're a research cognitive psychologist, and Josh is doing something to you I know you guys get done to a lot. He's asking you to give the human world therapeutic advice. Yeah, I know you're not a therapist, Tanya, but put on your therapist hat for a little bit.
Doctor.
All right, so you want my two pieces of advice as a psychologist for everyday explainers. So here are the two things that I would say. So first, I think we should try to avoid the vices. And I think a first step towards avoiding them is to recognize them, right? So if we know that we tend to be overly swayed by things like jargon and one I didn't mention, but length, people tend to like longer explanations in psychology studies where you evaluate word count. If we know we tend to be swayed by these sorts of things, we can at least be a little more critical when we encounter an explanation like that, right? We find it satisfying, and then we have to ask ourselves, is that really a good explanation, or did it just sort of sound like the person knew what they were talking about? And that's really what I'm picking up on. So that's piece of advice number one.
Okay, go ahead. Number two.
Number two is that I think instead of thinking about producing the best explanations or rejecting the worst explanations, I think we should think about being better explainers, right? Being better at engaging in the activity of explaining. And one reason that that's really valuable is illustrated by a phenomenon that psychologists call the illusion of explanatory depth. And what this is that if you ask people, how well do you understand how a microwave works or how a zipper works or how any number of other kinds of systems works, a lot of people will say, oh, I think I understand that pretty well. I think I could explain that. And then you say, okay, explain it.
I know.
we can give a moment for you or our listeners to try to imagine explaining how a zipper works. It seems incredibly easy. But once you actually try to explain it, you come to appreciate all of these gaps in what you thought you knew. So I think just engaging in the practice of actually explaining to yourself right. or to somebody else is a good kind of reality check. It sort of helps you be calibrated about what you actually do and you don't know. In the course of doing that, you might, you know,
this is
realize what you need to learn.
This is not a minor point. This is a really important point because it turns out, I don't know if you know this, but we actually had a former Berkeley colleague of yours on our show recently. It turns out that most people cannot explain the mechanism behind global warming. Even people pro-environment and all that, they cannot explain the mechanism of global warming. And climate denialism goes down as soon as you explain to people what the mechanism is, right? Because it's a simple, elegant, beautiful thing. And so it's striking, right? How many explanations we think we know and we don't know, and how many things we think we can explain when we don't. And this has huge social consequences. So I think you're making a really important point.
And this, in a way, brings us back, if I might, I don't, you know, I hate to be a kind of turf person here, but it brings us back to literature. You made this lovely point, Tanya, about reading as cultivating our capacity to imagine different possibilities. I also think about explaining reading. Right, the kind of work that literary critics do, that art critics do, that film critics do. If we all engage in that practice, I mean, that's not a bad habit to get into. We've got a complicated artifact in front of us that is puzzling, and we're, you know, if we invite ourselves to try to account for it, give an explanation for it. Well, what about that as a kind of a training ground for these good habits of explanation?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I find compelling in reading fiction is that just as in real life, you find yourself trying to explain why people behave the way they do, you do this in these fictional worlds too. But often in the fictional worlds, you get to explore experiences inside somebody else's head or in worlds that are very different from our own. And so you're going to have opportunities to engage in that kind of explanatory enterprise that might go beyond what you would in your everyday experience.
Right. And this brings me to another question. We didn't talk yet about beautiful explanations, right? So we've talked about good ones and bad ones. But I love this idea that there are beautiful explanations. I think it's totally true. And I certainly feel that way about some explanations of artworks. I feel that way about some scientific explanations of phenomena. So what does it make something beautiful? You know, yeah, we've talked about that being potentially dangerous, right? You get seduced by the beauty. But aren't there cases where it's just a good thing? You have this elegant, beautiful explanation that's exciting. Maybe it requires ingenuity to have come up with it. It's got these beautiful, clean lines. I mean, can you say something about that? Like, what does it make an explanation elegant? And can there be elegant explanations that aren't just misleading?
So I tend to think of beautiful explanations as explanations that exhibit all of the explanatory virtues to a great extent, right? So a beautiful explanation is one that's not only simple, but also explains a lot, for example, and does so in a way that's fruitful and so on, right? So when you get all of the explanatory virtues,
right.
Yeah, I think that's the core of it. Those can be true. I mean, certainly they can be. I think the thing that we need to be wary of is thinking that just because they're beautiful, that's enough to be done, to think we've done the job of showing they're true and we can stop. I think it can be a start to inquiry rather than an end to inquiry.
So I want to ask you a question about education, because all of us are in the business of educating the young. And I said something like to a bunch of students on the first day of class. I said these are Stanford freshmen. They're brilliant. But I said, you don't know how to read, because here's what you've been trained to do. You read something, sort of half read it, and you expect the professor to explain it to you. And I said, if you are the explained to, you will get less understanding than if you are the explainer. So I want you to be in the mode of trying to come up with explanations for what's going on your own, and we'll talk about them together and try to sort the good from the bad. But you've got to be an active explainer to really achieve understanding, not just a consumer of explanations. Do you think I was giving them misadvice or good advice?
I think that was excellent advice, and you might not have known it, Ken, but it's backed up by a couple of decades of research in psychology. So there's a phenomenon called the self-explanation effect, and I'm willing to bet we've all experienced it, and it's basically the phenomenon that sometimes you come to understand something better as a result of explaining it to yourself or to somebody else. And that's very different from being a consumer of an explanation. When you're the consumer of an explanation, you've gotten new information that you didn't have before. But when you're the one doing the explaining, It's not that you're getting new information that wasn't in your head already.
So
you're somehow rearranging it in a way that's valuable.
So why don't we make our educational system to exploit the fact that humans are inveterate explanation mongers and to try and make them more hungry for deeper, more explanatory explanations, because that's what the brain wants to do. Why is our education system the way it is?
So I do think to some extent teachers are aware of this and they use it in their classrooms. Often what the reason you have group activities and peer tutoring and so on
right.
is precisely because those kinds of activities promote explanation. But I think I want to correct, I think, perhaps a presupposition in what you just said.
Okay.
So I think it is true that we're explanation-seeking creatures, but we're also so selective about what we seek explanations for, right? So you can in principle explain anything. You know, why is this wall white?
Right.
Why is this yellow? You know, why is it exactly 252 right now? And so on. And most of the things that we could explain from our environment, we don't bother to explain. So even though we're extremely motivated to explain, I think we're also extremely selective
explain. I think you're right. Look, I think we've just scratched the tip of the iceberg, and this is a deep subject. But unfortunately, radio, you know, it has its time constraints. But why is that? Yeah, money. No, but not on this radio station. But Tanya, so I have to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Tanya Lombroso. She's a professor of psychology at Princeton University, director of the Concepts and Cognition Lab there. So, Josh, can you explain to me what you're thinking now?
I think it's such a fascinating field. I mean, you've on the one side, you've got like mansplaining, these are awful motivations for explaining, and you've got bad explanations like conspiracy theories and skeleton key theories and everything's neoliberalism.
Yeah.
On the other side, you've got not just great explanations, but beautiful explanations and that are true, both true and beautiful. And you know, at the end of the day, I think I love your advice the best, Ken. You know,
thank you.
You're welcome. Go out there. I mean, also Tanya's, right? Go out there and explain things.
Yeah.
Get in the habit, even of zippers, even of everyday things. Get in the habit of explaining things. You'll understand things better, and you'll become a better contributor to discourse.
I totally agree. I mean, there's much to explain. The habit of searching for explanation is an important part of the human mind. There are deep questions here. And one of the thing I love best about Tanya is she's bringing psychology and philosophy back together after their separation 100-plus years ago. But anyway, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, well, no apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, can anyone possibly explain how fast this guy talks? It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Occam's razor, that clean blade which etches the shortest straight line from effect to cause, the best, the simplest explanation, has been dulled, given away to Goodwill, which wouldn't even take it because it's a razor. A child might swallow it, could get infected by bacteria and cause the death of thousands of preteens in small towns in Ohio, which fluoridate their drinking water and don't vaccinate their children. It's not a moral panic. It's a simple abandoning of common sense. We pretend we are great believers in common sense, but it's more honored in the breach, as they say, than the observance. Oh, the circles our logic weaves. Experts have always been with us, and they're quite good if left to their own advices and not telling us to avoid microwaves. They potter about and invent things like cars and phones and stereos and philosophical systems and stage productions and movies and highways. But when it comes to explaining it all, they often come a cropper. Part of that has to do with how complicated it all is now. Tell me how a car works. Well, first you need to explain how internal combustion works. Before that, you need to share the concepts of flammability, tiny explosions, moving parts, the wheel, and by extrapolation, automobile factories, license plates, unions, mergers, overseas competition, freeways, dirt roads, drag races, climate change. I mean, where do you even begin? 10 years from now, we might not even have cars, or we'll all be dead from global warming, so why bother? Okay, so keep up with the times and try to explain solar or wind power. And immediately you get fossil fuel propagandists accusing you of being a traitor to the free marketplace. And if you support the local zoo, you're a socialist. Common sense is history. Look what happened to mansplaining. It used to be the Yankee way of knowledge. Some guy, hopefully with patches on the elbows of his cardigan, knocking the dottle from his pipe, explaining the principles of stereophonic sound, or windshield factor, that's a good one, to a woman or child until he runs screaming from the room to forge a new life in California. In some cases, restraining orders are issued, with no men to explain how they work. It's chaos. Of course, we've always had a degree of magical thinking in the way we approach problems. We have astrology, which still posts predictions next to the news. We have conspiracy theories. We have Democrats and Republicans, magical beings, the aspects of which are debated and shift daily. We have a leader, President Trump, who, as Ramrod in the Cowboy Crew, is more given to stampeding the herd with loud, boastful blather than soothing the fretful longhorns with Gene Autry tunes. We dash hither, thither, confused. So now we resort to complicated, even paranoid schemes to explain how things work. Trump colluded with Russia to win the election. Oh, no? Well, Democrats colluded with Hillary to collude with Russia to... What now? It's very confusing. And every red flag could be a false flag, depending on whether you're watching Hannity or Maddow. The very frustration of trying to explain the very simplest of actions, like making your bed and lying in it, which used to be child's play. Not cursing a blues freak when a thing doesn't go your way. Getting somebody in charge who has our welfare in mind and not some personal pocketbook-driven agenda. Well, will you look at that room? There's an elephant in there. It's full of elephants, in fact. So let's just not go in that room anymore. Is that a solution? No? Well, maybe there's not a problem then. Think of that. Instead, let's invent, say, QAnon, which uncovered a global conspiracy of pedophile bureaucrats, I think, headed by Hillary Clinton, for some reason. And Donald Trump is going to throw them all in jail and take charge. So wait, he's not in charge now? No? Election 2016, you got some splaining to do. Get a man to do it, though, will you? Just for old time's sake? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'll explain.
Okay, explain.